Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mind Shift. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you once again from The Rock here in North Wales. This is all about critical thinking about God, the church, and spirituality, and I am excited to be sitting here today with my sister, Valerie. Do you want to say hello to everybody?
Hey, what's
That's up? My sister, Valerie. She's been here with her husband, Mike, for a couple of weeks, and then we sent him home, didn't we?
Yep.
We sent him packing, and we went on an epic World War I journey. Yes. We went across the channel to France. We went all the way to Verdun and worked our way up through the Somme region and ended up in Belgium. That was an epic trip. We just got back a couple of days ago. And before Valerie leaves, tomorrow, you're heading out tomorrow.
Yes, I am.
Flying back to Seattle to be with her husband and her dog.
Yes.
Fergus, you miss your dog more than your husband at this point.
No,
it's a toss-up.
It's a toss-up.
They have a new little dog called Fergus, and she misses him. I guess you miss your husband, too.
Yeah, we'll
give Mike a chance.
And my kids, and my grandkids.
Oh, yeah. But we wanted to talk about this issue, because this podcast is called Mind Shift. Used to be called the Preacher's Forum Podcast, but I realized that title was too restrictive. People thought it was all about preaching. And so I've changed it to Mind Shift, and we did a lot of talking. We've been talking over the years about our upbringing, and it's a pretty messed up story.
Oh, yeah.
I won't say our ages, but we're mature now.
Yes.
We're mature.
Finally,
yeah. Well, some would argue that. I don't know. But we have a lot of stuff that we came out of as children. And, okay, we will say, how much older are you than me? We won't name names or ages, but...
I'm 9 years older.
Okay, so Valerie's 9 years older than me, and we came out of a very fundamentalist upbringing with some parents that were trying to live according to, you know, some of Bill Gothard's teachings, and they were heavily into that, and we'll get more into that in a minute. But I think this podcast is aimed at people who either came out of evangelicalism, fundamentalism, or who are just wanting to know more about some of the toxic teaching and theology, how it affects people, isn't it?
Right, right.
And the mind shift part of it is how you come out of that on the other side.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people that they're still trapped in it, aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And they are struggling with mental health issues and so many other problems as a result of being raised in such a toxic environment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, both Valerie and I were raised in the Seattle, Washington area. And it's interesting because we were just talking before we started recording this about the difference in our upbringing. What would you say? Because the fact that you're 9 years older than me, you had a 9-year window where things were different, weren't they?
Yes.
Before I was born. I was the last child of 5 older sisters. What was the difference between those 9 years, would you say, and then when I came along? Well, everything was ruined then when I came along.
No, it wasn't anything you did, obviously.
Oh, good.
But when I was 3, your father married my mother, and so I was, we had a separate life before they got married, our mother and my older sister and me. And we weren't a part of any church. We didn't go to any church, really. Once in a while, we would visit the church that our grandparents were at. And my grandfather would preach there once in a while.
Yeah, they were friends or Quakers, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah, Quaker background. And we would visit there once in a while. But I don't ever remember being involved in any church on a regular basis until after my mom married your dad, who's my stepfather, and that's a whole other story.
It's a very strange story because Valerie and I are technically half brother, half sister. We have the same mother, but Valerie's father is my father's brother.
Older brother, yes.
So my mom was married to your dad, and we had Valerie and Jeanette, our oldest two sisters, And then he left. They got a divorce. Then my mom married my dad, who was his brother.
Yes.
So already it's a Jerry Springer show.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You literally couldn't make this stuff up.
Well, a lot of that, too, was the fact that my grandparents, our grandparents, pressured the other two remaining brothers that one of them really needed to marry our mom, according to Old Testament, how they did it in the Old Testament, which harkens back to their Quaker background. And they said, one of you needs to step up and marry her and take care of the two children. And she ended up marrying your dad. And they were married in 1960. I would have been three. And we started going to church fairly quickly after they got married. We would go to Sunday school and maybe visit here and there. Never really found a church that they really liked. And we had our next sister born. She's 4 years younger than I am. And then the next sister was born. And then the house we were living in at the time in Seattle was too small. So we moved to Kent and we started going to a church. I was around five, a local church that was just barely getting off the ground starting.
Right. So it had been going.
Yeah, they'd planted it. And wonderful, wonderful pastor. I just really love that guy. So I was used to a very loving church. We all took care of each other. It was a very close-knit church. Us kids grew up together. That's where I accepted Christ and prayed the prayer, the magic prayer.
The sinner's prayer.
The sinner's prayer. I got baptized. My stepfather baptized me. And so I started that church when I was about five. So I grew up every year going through Sunday school, junior high, and high school youth group. And we were all really close. And it was such a family feeling. And then when I was about 11 or 12, we had a great family at home, very loving. My parents got along really well. Us kids were all really close. Eventually, our younger sister was born, and then you, Clint, were born. And we were all very close-knit and very happy family. Then in about, I'm not sure when, 68, 69, somewhere in there, 1968, 69, the church got involved in the Bill Gothard Basic Youth Conflict Seminars. And a lot of the people started going to this, and it completely changed my life.
And not for the better.
Not for the better. It was horrible. And we went from a carefree, happy, full of laughter family to children filled with fear. Our parents went completely overboard on what they called discipline. It was really physical abuse.
Yeah, it's more like child abuse.
It was child abuse, abused all of us children. And I didn't know what to think or how to act because here I'd been a carefree child up till about the age of 11, 12, 13, and suddenly I'm told that I'm stupid, I don't have a mind, why aren't you doing better, you're being disrespectful, you're ugly, all these terrible things. I'm getting beat practically every day for the smallest infractions. If she didn't like, if a mom didn't like the look you gave her, she'd just slap you or pull your hair, jerk you around by your hair. Another thing they'd do is they would beat us with pieces of kindling, of wood, and would beat us for, I don't know, seemed like forever, 10, 15 minutes. And it was just a horrible, it was such a change that my reaction was I completely rebelled, and I would get into big fights with them. I didn't care what they thought of me. I stood up for myself and said, I don't like how you're treating me. You need to stop treating me. But then that would bring on more beatings.
Yeah, because you're the rebellious child.
Exactly. And God didn't want a rebellious child. They needed to break my will. I wasn't under their authority, air quotes.
The famous umbrella of authority.
Yes, the famous umbrella. And supposedly, my stepdad was supposed to be this giant umbrella of protection over us. And if supposedly through the Bill Gothard teaching, if he had any holes or sin in his life, then Satan could get to us children, and or we could take ourselves out of this umbrella, from under this umbrella. And that's what I got told I was doing, that I'd pulled myself out of this umbrella of his protection, and therefore Satan was attacking me, and I wasn't under God's authority, I wasn't under their authority. And I was just a kid. I didn't know what any of this meant, but it was whatever I was doing apparently was wrong.
Yeah, you were getting spanked for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, now what would you say accounted for that change? Why was such, I mean, yes, we have the Bill Gothard theology, mm-hmm. you know, which is a whole nother subject. I mean, and now it's come out that Bill Gothard's been accused of sexual abuse and all sorts of mm-hmm. things. And mm-hmm. his teaching is, when you look at it now, it's unbelievably you know, bizarre and strange theology that he's come out with. But, you know, this idea of spanking the child till you mm-hmm. break their will.
Yes, yes.
You know you've succeeded when they start crying.
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
apparently when you've reached that point and you can stop spanking them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you have a child who's rebellious, then mm-hmm. they need to have their will broken even more.
Yes, yes.
And I grew up in that environment knowing only that.
Yeah.
So I received thousands and thousands of spankings, sometimes two and three spankings a
mm-hmm,
day
mm-hmm.
with my sister.
Yeah.
We were in trouble all the time. Mm-hmm. So it clearly wasn't
but
working.
But you were just being children. You were just being kids.
We were just being naughty
kids. It wasn't
kids.
That you were planning, okay, I need to get 15 spankings today. What can I do
to earn those
15 spankings? Because I want to be under God's authority and under Dad and Mom's authority.
It
wasn't anything like that. We were just being kids. And there was no nurturing. There was no praise, because Bill Gothard taught that if you praise your children, you'll make them vain.
Of course you will.
Here I'm, you know, going into junior high. I want to look nice for school. And at one point, my stepfather said, I'm going to take the mirrors down in the bathroom because you girls are getting too vain. So we don't want that. God doesn't want vanity in your life. And we said, no, you can't do that. Please. We need at least a mirror. And so we actually won one battle, and he left the mirrors up. But I think a lot of it, too, was a big part was, and this just kind of struck me the other day, was the fact that our mom is very strong-minded, and she is a leader type of personality. She has a one-track mind. She wants to be in charge.
Yeah, very focused.
And extremely focused. And so she was able to do that. Her personality did fine with that before the Bill Gothard thing, as kind of the leader in the marriage, because our dad was more laid back and he was kind of chill and he just let her do it. And they were playing their roles correctly.
It seemed to work.
It worked fine up for the first 10 years of their marriage or so. And then once they went to the Bill Gothard, she was told, no, you need to come under his authority. He needs to be the spiritual leader in the marriage. But he wasn't that. That wasn't his personality. And so they started clashing. She started clashing with us. And she would say, you know, to him, hey, do something about this child. You know, she's not respecting my authority. You need to spank her. And he's coming home from work just going, what? I have to spank her. I don't know anything about it. I read an excerpt in his diary just a few years ago. It said, this is from when I was a teenager, it said, had to spank Val again today because she got caught talking to a boy on the phone.
Oh, you're a terrible person,
I was
Val.
A teenage girl.
Isn't that what girls do?
Junior high and high school. But apparently I got spanked for talking to a boy on the phone. And so when I was about 15, 16, somewhere in there, then I wanted to start dating. But they would not let me date anyone except for someone from either our church, a Church of Christ, or an affiliate church, another Church of Christ. So I'd try to pick out these different guys. I wasn't really interested in any of them. It was a little bit enough to say, yeah, if this is the only way I can date, so be it. Okay, so I'll go out with so-and-so.
Take one of those nerdy Christian boys.
Yeah.
Better than nothing, yeah. I guess.
And they weren't any better than the non-Christian boys, because a lot of them were hands all over. But so that was the only time I could date. And I had to bring the boy home to the house. They interviewed him to find out, is he a Christian? What does his parents do? Where does his dad work? Are your parents Christians? What church do you go to? Have you been baptized? Have you accepted the Lord? I mean, they would do this big interview.
The Spanish Inquisition.
And of course, a lot of times that was the end of that boy. He's just like, I'm out of here. This is ridiculous.
He wasn't polishing a shotgun.
Yeah. So when I was 16, I started dating a boy from school behind their back.
And he wasn't a Christian?
He was not a Christian. He did not come from a Christian home. And I knew that if they caught me, that I would get beat.
Big trouble.
So I dated him behind their backs. I would say, well, I'm going to go and meet a girlfriend. We're going to go to a football game or whatever. But instead, he and I would go to the movies. And we would date behind their backs. And this went on for quite some time until the summer I was 17. I discovered that I might be pregnant. I didn't know because I had no idea. I had never been told the facts of life. I had no clue. And so I knew there was something physically wrong with me. At first, I thought I was dying, that I might have cancer. I was petrified. My body's changing. It's doing these weird things. And so I spent that summer and my tummy's getting bigger and bigger. And I think, well, okay, I'll cut back on my food. Maybe I'll lose some weight. And it never dawned on me until one time our family had gone camping. And I was wearing a swimsuit. And my mother looked at me and she's like, what's going on? So they took me aside as soon as we got home and said, are you pregnant? And that was like an epiphany to me. I was like, oh, maybe I am.
That's what's wrong with me.
And they said, lay across the bed. And they spanked me for getting pregnant at 16 years old.
Because that'll solve the problem.
Yeah.
It's too late then.
He spanked me with a piece of kindling wood. And it didn't make me unpregnant.
No.
But he got the message across, apparently, that I had disobeyed him. I had ruined their lives. Their first reaction was, how could you do this to us?
That's what they said.
How could you do this to us? And I said, I didn't even know I could get pregnant. I didn't know anything about that.
And of course, the irony of the whole thing, there's so many ironies, isn't there, that if they had given you the parental guidance, maybe you would have avoided getting pregnant, but you didn't even know that having sex could lead you to getting pregnant.
So absolutely.
A lot of the blame falls back on them, but of course they're spanking you.
Yes.
It's all your fault. Yeah. They accept no responsibility. Yeah. It's all about them.
Yeah.
Because I can remember I'm about 9 or so at this stage when Valerie got pregnant. And I can remember our dad was an elder at the church that we attended, this Church of Christ. And he got up and gave a big speech about how he had to resign as an elder. And he said, the reason I have to step down is because the Bible says that if you're an elder and you can't shepherd the church and the flock of God, you can't be an elder if you can't manage your family. And so he, again, made it all about him. And everybody came up to him and they were like, oh, brother, you know, we're so sorry. Your daughter is so rebellious. And, you know, please don't step down. No, it's what the Bible says, and I need to do that. And so he got all this sympathy and all this support. My parents did, you know. And so, again, they made it all about themselves and how it made them look you know, your actions embarrass them and mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah, and they what they were doing with me is they said, you can't live here at home anymore. We will go through the Bill Gothard. They had like a counseling service, which also did an adoption service.
And ironically, the name of that service...
Burden Bearers.
Was called Burden Bearers. Now, yes. Whose burden were they bearing?
Yes, yes.
Certainly wasn't yours.
It wasn't mine. It was
it
not mine.
It eased their burden yes. because they yes. were able to shove you out of the house.
Yes.
And yeah. closet you away, didn't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, they sent me away probably 75 miles away to a foster home that took in unwed mothers. And... I went and lived there. I moved into that place in November. I was still 17 at the time. And because I was 17, I legally couldn't make any decisions. So our parents made all the decisions on that I was going to give up the child for adoption. They just shoved papers in front of my face and said, here, sign this. The only input I had in the whole thing was... I said, I want to have my child go to a family that couldn't have children, and I wanted the child to go to a Christian home, a loving Christian home, which she ended up going to, which is wonderful. So, but that was the only input I had. And then the birth father also had to sign some documents, and that was it. I didn't know what the documents were. They put me on welfare. It paid for my medical, for all the prenatal stuff. And then I got $100 stipend to live off. But yet the foster home charged me $90 a month for rent. And so I had to pay, that was for my room and board. So I lived off $10 a month. I enrolled myself in high school there in this other city. And so I was able to go to high school from November to January until I got so pregnant that I couldn't literally fit into a student desk, and I had to drop out in right then in the semester. And I was 18, so I could legally take myself out of school. And so I continued to live in the foster home. I basically had the clothes on my back. I was not allowed to bring anything other than a small suitcase. Whatever I was told I could put into that suitcase, that's what I could take to this foster home, which was really nothing. It was more like an overnight case and toiletries. So at one point, my best girlfriend's stepmother took me shopping because she realized that I didn't have any maternity clothes even. And so she took me to charity shops and bought me some clothes. And I was told by our parents that I could not have any contact with any of my siblings. And being the second oldest, I was really close with all of my siblings. I was kind of like the captain of the ship. I was their protector. I at times would try to break up my mother beating one of my younger siblings. I actually jumped on her back one time to stop her from beating one of my sisters. And that was my role. I was the protector. I was the captain of these siblings. And here I'm suddenly just yanked out of that, told not to have any contact. I couldn't call you guys. I couldn't have any kind of contact. And because they looked at me like I was a sinful, rebellious person full of poison, yeah. and that I might infect my other siblings with this satanic boil that was bursting or something. I don't know what they were thinking. But so I couldn't have any contact. I got to come home at Christmas time one time, and I think I was just there overnight, and then they took me right back the next day after Christmas back to the foster home. I had no friends in the city that I lived in. Because when I was in high school there and I was pregnant, because of the timing, mid to late 70s, if you were pregnant and not married back then, you were a pariah in society. And I was treated by the other students like I had some kind of communicable disease. and they didn't talk to me. I sat alone in the lunchroom. Even in the classroom, I'd go and sit in a desk, and nobody would sit by me. It would be the last two desks, the last two students that came in that room had to sit by me.
And they had no choice.
They had no choice. And I just, you know, I just finished what schooling I could, and not getting to be able to graduate. I was short a couple of credits, but I just had to quit school. I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, you had no choice.
Yeah, yeah.
So on top of the trauma of being rejected by your parents, being forced to live in another city miles away from your family, your friends, you've got no support.
No, none.
Because I remember we visited you one time, I think, mm-hmm. while you were living in that foster home, and it was only to drop off a few things that you needed.
Right.
It wasn't a long visit. We saw your room, and then we were out of there.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm 9, 10 years old, mm-hmm. and I'm missing my sister, wondering how she's doing, because we couldn't call you. We couldn't talk on the phone.
No.
And so we see you for maybe half an hour or less, and we're on the road again going back
mm-hmm.
home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so our parents did a good job of keeping the family, the siblings, apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were afraid you were going to infect us all.
And you and I had a conversation many, many years ago about this, and you shared with me how you were feeling when I suddenly left. That, you know, repeat that.
Well, I'm 9 years old, and I can remember going back to before you got put in the foster home. Our parents would have these big family meetings, you know, and Valerie and I were super close, even though there was 9 years apart. I remember you used to teach me how to draw and things like that, you know, when I was a kid. I was interested in art and things, and we were really close, and my parents had these big, with all of us sitting in this room, in the living room, and they were basically like announcing, well, Val's pregnant, and she's done a terrible thing, and
mm-hmm.
there were these huge fights and screaming, and all of us kids are sitting around the perimeter of the room watching our parents that we love, with our sister that we love, screaming at each other, and we don't know mm-hmm. whose side to take. We don't know. It's a total chaotic environment.
And then
suddenly you're just gone.
Yeah.
You know, and
no explanation.
No real explanation. Mm-mm. You know, we put Val in a foster home. She's going to have her baby. And that was it.
Yeah.
And you were done. And it was just like almost as if you died and just mm-hmm. had been, you know, cut out of our lives without really any closure at all.
Yeah.
And we see you one or two times maybe in the span of the time that you're pregnant. And then, you know, I mean, I'm 9, 10 years old. I don't have a car. I can't drive. You know.
Yeah.
So it's very damaging for sure to see all this and have no way to process that. Mm-hmm. As a 9-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And, you know, all my sisters are, you know, just sitting there with our jaws on the floor watching mm-hmm. all this. The family literally tear itself apart.
Yeah.
You know, and I keep coming back to this thing of we're supposedly a Christian family.
Yeah.
We're a church-going family. My dad's an elder.
Yes.
He's highly respected. He was very heavily involved in the Bill Gothard.
Mm-hmm.
He was chairman of the host and hostesses committee.
Yeah.
He was not just a regular attendee. They were involved in leadership. They used to go on retreats. He led worship in the church. He played piano.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a country gospel band.
Yes.
Him and our mom were in a country gospel quartet.
Yeah.
They did gigs all around, you know, so they were real good Christians.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And yet the family life that nobody else saw but us was horrific.
It was. It was a nightmare because we would get Sunday mornings. It was an absolute terrifying morning because our mother's freaking out. She's screaming at us, yelling at us, smacking us around. Get ready for church. Get ready for church. Get ready for church.
The ultimate irony.
We'd get in the car. She'd be screaming, yelling at us all the way to church. We'd get out of the car, and she'd say something like, "You guys better behave." We would file in, and our family, all 8 of us, 6 children and our parents, sat in the front row.
Yep, we had
Here
our
we
pew.
Are. That was the Haycock pew.
Yep.
This is where you guys sit, and you better act perfectly.
Yeah, put on the plastic smile.
Yes, put on the plastic smile.
That.
And everybody's were dressed nice. Our hair is combed. Luckily, we had a mirror still.
You did have a mirror.
Yeah. And we were this perfect family, perfect Christian family. But yet, the minute we got back in the car, the hair pulling started, the slapping started. all the way home, scream and yell. And I remember one instance we were getting ready for church, and our little sister was carrying a bowl of Jell-O for a potluck after church. And she was walking towards the car. We're getting ready to go to church. And she tripped and dropped this bowl of Jell-O onto the concrete sidewalk. And our mother flew into a rage. And how dare you, clumsy, stupid, idiot child? What do you think you're doing? And it was just, she tripped.
Just a kid.
You know?
It happens. Just a little, accidents
she was like
happen.
8 or 9 when that happened. And, you know, well, what are we going to bring to church potluck now? You know, I was like, oh my goodness, the world didn't just end.
You know,
but that's, yeah, but at church, oh, we were the perfect family. But at home, our life was an absolute nightmare. We were terrified of our mother. We never knew when she was going to strike out at us, either verbally, emotionally, physically. We had no idea. And we just felt like we were constantly on eggshells. As a matter of fact, I can remember up until I was probably 55, 56 years old, I was still afraid of her. And I talked to my other sisters, and they were still afraid of her in our 50s.
Yeah, grown, married, have families.
Yeah, still
long
afraid
since
of
left
her.
The house.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and there's so much more going on in that picture, because going back to the time when you're living in the foster home, you're pregnant, you haven't had your baby yet. You know, as I was saying, we're living in this toxic environment. We'd grown up in it. And about that time, I was 9 or 10, my mom started coming to me, because we always had kind of a special relationship where we could talk. And she started unloading on me all this terrible stuff about our dad, about how he was such a terrible father and a terrible husband, and he wasn't a spiritual leader, and he wasn't the head of the household. And, you know, I wish he'd just do a Bible study with our family, and why doesn't he do more and everything. And that's got to go back to mm-hmm. what you talked about with the Bill Gothard theology,
mm-hmm.
the man must be the head of the
yes,
house.
Yes.
So she kind of was the head of the house mm-hmm. before they started
right,
going.
Right.
Their roles switched, and he mm-hmm. couldn't or wouldn't live up to that perfect ideal.
Yes, yes.
And so I learned when I was in counseling in college that this is called emotional incest. This
mm-hmm.
is what they call triangulation or emotional incest, where a parent unloads on a child, their frustrations about their partner, and it's incredibly damaging, incredibly inappropriate,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
and what it succeeded in doing, because me and my dad were really close. I was his little buddy, because
mm-hmm.
he'd had all these girls, no disrespect
mm-hmm.
to girls, but they
yeah.
were waiting for a boy to come along, and I was yeah. named the same name as my dad.
Right.
They named
right.
me the same name as him, and we were little buddies. Every time he wanted to go to the store, you know,
mm-hmm.
oh, you want to come with me? Yeah, let's go, and we'd play and wrestle around, and we were pretty close. And I think my mom was jealous of that closeness.
Yes.
And part of the emotional incest was a way to drive a wedge in between me and my father.
Mm-hmm.
And it succeeded
mm-hmm.
because I started to have a lot of contempt for him. And I started looking at him and thinking, you know, you're treating our mother horribly.
Mm-hmm.
You're a jerk. You're not even a good husband. You're not a good father. And when I was 13, I came home from summer camp. I'd had a terrible week of summer camp, Christian summer
yeah.
camp,
yeah.
where I'd gone and I didn't have any friends. All my mm-hmm. friends went to a different camp earlier in the summer, and I couldn't go because I think we were on vacation at that time. So I went another week, and I didn't know anybody. I was alone the whole week. And I came home. I'd had a terrible week, and it was one of the worst weeks of my life. I walked in the door on the Saturday, having, you know, driven home with my friends or from the church. The first thing my dad said was, go mow the lawn.
Mm.
And he'd let it go for a week, and it was like a foot
oh.
high. And we got into a big argument, and our relationship that day was forever severed.
Mm.
You know, all my frustrations and pent up anger about all the stuff that had gone on with you and what my mom had poisoned me against him for the rest of his life. He died, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
I think so.
I mean, we obviously had a communicating relationship. We could talk and stuff, but we were never close.
Mm-hmm.
Our relationship was destroyed. And my mom does play a big part in
yeah.
bringing that about.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got all these things going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, while you're pregnant.
Yeah, yep.
So can we?
Yeah.
You want to go back to when, okay, you're in this foster home. Let's pick up the story there. what happened when you had your daughter then?
So what happened then, I went into labor really early in the hours. I went to the hospital. They knew that she was going up for adoption. And so I had her, but I passed out. I completely passed out. And I didn't wake up. I heard her cry, and I passed out. And I didn't wake up for several hours later, and I was on a complete different floor. They wouldn't even put me on the same floor as the other women who had had children. I was on a completely different floor and completely isolated. And they did not want me going anywhere near the nursery. They told me, you will not go to the nursery. You will not see your child. You had a girl, and they gave me some other paperwork to sign. I mean, I'm just barely waking up. I'm still kind of groggy. And they're saying, here, sign this paperwork so that you can be released from the hospital. And so I signed it. I don't even know what it was. My then boyfriend, her birth father, came to the hospital. He had to sign the documents too. So I'm assuming they were giving up our right to being parents.
You're releasing your parental.
Yeah, right. So I signed the documents and got out of the hospital the next day. My boyfriend at the time took me back to the foster home because I had belongings there that I wanted to get. So I gathered all those up, told those people goodbye, because they had treated me really bad. They were a supposedly Christian home.
Oh, of course.
But
they,
treated me like I was an indentured servant. I did all the cleaning, even though I was heavily pregnant. I cleaned the house. They had a two-story house. I cleaned upstairs and downstairs. I babysat their children. They had two toddlers. I babysat their children for them. I helped cook. I helped clean.
So it was a pretty sweet gig for them.
It was, completely. Plus, I had to pay rent.
Oh, of course.
$90 a month.
Well, the burden bearers.
Yes.
I don't know who's. Their burdens,
yeah,
too.
I bore their. I had nothing.
They
I was
didn't
destitute.
Have to cook, clean.
Yeah, I was
and
completely
you were
destitute.
Paying for the privilege of.
Of doing it, yeah.
Living in this terrible foster home.
Yeah. So, anyway, crazy. So my then boyfriend, my boyfriend took me to his house, and I called our parents and I said, I'm home. I've, you know, given up the baby. Can I come home? And they said, absolutely not. You are not welcome in our home ever again. 18 years old.
Right.
I had turned 18 in November, and that was in March. And I had nothing. I had that little suitcase. I had some belongings in there. I said, I don't know what to do. And I didn't want to stay with them, with my boyfriend's family, because at the time his mother had cancer. And she was really sick. So I called my best friend's mom, and I'm in just tears. I'm just bawling. And
where
I say,
am I gonna go?
I don't know where to go. I have nothing. I have no money. My parents will not let me come back home. I can't see any of my siblings still. I couldn't even see my pastor. They wouldn't even let me do counseling with the pastor that I had been raised with. And they didn't want anybody in the church, you know, knowing where I was. I had no contact with anybody. And so when I talked to my best girlfriend's mom, she said, you get over here right now. You can move in with us. And they lived in this little tiny house. There was, you know, what, four or five of them at the time living in this little house, this little three-bedroom house. And she's like, you get over here right now, Val, and you can live with us. And so she ended up taking me in. She was really the mother that I really needed. And she was a wonderful woman. I loved her immensely, and she loved me immensely. But she took me in. She got me a job right away. Helped me go and get on my feet finally. And I was able to eventually, once I got, you know, on my feet again, I could go to her. But I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but I didn't know it.
Depression as
postpartum,
well.
And I can remember just
all the trauma of having lived through the last year. Yes.
Oh, it was horrible. Absolutely horrible.
It's indescribable, really.
And I was not getting any kind of counseling at all. I remember one shortly after I moved in with my best friend's family, I can remember going underneath a bush out in the yard and just screaming and screaming and screaming, I want my baby back. I want my baby back. And I had no idea later, years and years later, I found out that I had legally, in the state that we lived in, up to a year to get her back.
Right. So you could have actually reclaimed her.
I could have actually taken her back. But I had no idea. No, I had no idea.
Sign these papers and whisk the baby away.
Yep,
and you didn't even get to see her.
Yep. And I also found out during the time that I was destitute that her adoptive parents, wonderful people, but they paid huge sum of money. I can't remember the figures, but it was over $10,000.
Was this to our friends, like, the Burden Bearers?
Through the Burden Bearers.
Oh, there they are again.
They got paid by the adoptive parents. It was somewhere between the figure, I want to say between $10,000 and $25,000 to be able to adopt my child.
Yeah, just crazy amounts of money.
Where I'm destitute, poor. I'm barely feeding myself bread and water. Literally, I ate bread and water. And but yet this Burden Bearers, this Christian
in air quotes
group, was getting all this money for me.
Yeah, what did they do to deserve $25,000?
Shuffled
whatever
some
it was.
Paperwork around, got signatures. That's it. They never counseled me. They didn't ever bear my burden.
I was going to say, you had a lot of burdens that didn't get borne by anybody except yourself. You had to.
Myself. That was it. I only had myself.
I just cannot get over the fact that you have all these sort of layers, parents that are Christians is another layer of all this story. You know, we're both parents. We have kids. I've got two daughters. You've got a son and a daughter. You know, I can't imagine just as on a human level, mm-hmm. as a parent, mm-hmm. doing that to my own child.
Yeah.
Kicking them out and leaving them with nothing and no support. Mm-hmm. So how could you do that just as purely a parent?
Yeah.
And then somehow justify all this mm-hmm. with what the Bible says.
Yeah, yeah.
About loving other people mm-hmm. and taking care of the needy and the helpless, the widows, the orphans.
Yes.
What about those verses in the Bible
that
were conveniently overlooked by our parents and the, quote, burden bearers?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I just don't understand any of that, you know? So
I was really, for this Christian group, burden bearers, I was treated as a commodity.
It
was
a number.
Was just a number. I was just...
Well, you were a prophet.
I was prophet for them.
I mean, here's a single
prophet.
Gal who's, who's vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And they're taking
Young.
Advantage of you.
Yes.
And they made a lot of money.
Yes, they did.
By,
yes.
you know, hooking your baby up with a family.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yep.
it's just crazy to
and
think
how
about
many
how
other,
all this happens.
How many others were there?
Thousands. There must
I'm sure.
have been.
Yeah. Very lucrative business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just a commodity. And I know that her adoptive parents had tried to adopt other children prior to her. And... for some reason, it fell through, but they adopted her. You know, years later, I was reunited with my daughter, and I find out that she just had a wonderful life. She says she was spoiled rotten, and I couldn't have asked for more.
And you couldn't have provided that.
I could
in the
not,
state you were in.
No, I could not have. And it did turn out that it was a good thing for her because. I tried to get away from that boyfriend, and he beat me up several times really badly. I didn't end up in the hospital, but I tried to go to my family for help. They said, nope, sorry, you made your bed now. You get to lie in it. Too bad for you. And he would stalk me, and I just kept having to move and hide from him. And the last straw was he on the phone threatened suicide, and I was at the point I said, fine, go ahead. I'm waiting. And then that was the last time I ever heard from him. So, but all through those years, I wasn't receiving any kind of therapy or counseling. I was still trying to please my parents somehow. Anything I could do, you know, something that I'm doing. I've got my life together. I'm working. I have a nice apartment. You know, I was saving money. I had money in the bank. They still wasn't good enough. Nothing I could do was ever good enough. And so then I spent the next 40 years trying to please, especially my mother, probably because it's, you know, that's my mother. I want to make her happy, but I could never make her happy. I know when I had my daughter with my husband, they didn't even go to the hospital. They didn't even go to the hospital when she was born. And a couple of weeks later, I waited and waited. Nothing, no calls, nothing. Finally, I called them and I was like, hey, Dad answered the phone. I said, hey, are you going to come and see your granddaughter? Well, we've been busy and da-da-da, and we just haven't had time, da-da-da. And I said, you know, I have a wonderful husband, beautiful house. I have a beautiful daughter. And I said, what is it going to take for you guys to love me and accept me? What do I have to do for you guys? This isn't good enough? You know, I don't know what to do.
What else can I do?
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was a couple of days later, they finally came and saw her. She was almost 3 weeks old.
Having a granddaughter and not being at the hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, when we had our first daughter, you know, everybody came down because we were living in Portland and Oregon at the time, and they all drove down from Seattle, and it was a big, exciting thing. Mm-hmm. But you'd want to be there. Mm-hmm. I'd want to be there if it was my daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't imagine that. Now, getting on this subject of mind shift, we talked about this before. We said, okay, the name of the podcast is Mind Shift. It's about having these mind shifts and changing the way you think about things, you know, because this is going back a long time, these stories we're telling.
Right.
But there's another layer to this whole story as well, and that is probably about, what was it, 5-6 years ago, it came out that our father was allegedly he was addicted to pornography, and this was our mother made him confess, in air quotes. But then, as the story became a little bit more pronounced, it comes out that he was basically a pedophile.
Yes.
And this is all through those years when we were in church, when he was an elder, a worship leader. Yes. We don't even know the extent of the things he did.
No.
But we certainly know that he abused you and our other sister when you were little girls.
Yes.
And unfortunately, the sad truth is that our mother ended up siding with him.
Yes.
And turned against all of us, well, some of us children who were trying to figure out what our father had done.
Yes.
And he took his secrets with him to the grave.
Yeah.
Even though you confronted him, didn't you? And I confronted him before he died and asked him to tell the truth about what he had done. Mm-hmm. And he refused.
Yeah.
And he died a few years ago, allegedly as a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, you call yourself a Christian, then that means you believe that when you die, you're going to be standing before God.
Right.
And he's going to say to you, you had a chance to clear the slate, to ask for forgiveness of the people you've hurt. You know, I said, do you want to be in that position?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you've got a chance now before you die to get this all off your chest and tell everybody what you've done. And he didn't. He wouldn't.
No.
You know, and the most freeing thing for me, the mind shift for me, and I think maybe for you as well, was we had to end up cutting my mother and some of our siblings completely out of our lives.
Yes.
And that was the most freeing thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
My life has radically changed for the better since I made that decision. Yeah. I don't know what you
When this all came out with him, I ended up going back to therapy. And I've had to do therapy almost always, off and on through my entire adult life because of the messed up childhood that we had. And so I was going to therapy, and the therapist suggested that I physically take something. And what she suggested is take a rock, write on it your feelings, your emotions in felt pen, and then bury it. Well, I happen to live on a lake. So I thought, aha. So I took one rock that represented my mother, one rock that represented my stepfather. And I just wrote all over them my emotions, like things like anger, bitterness, fear, loathing, hatred. And I just wrote all these words.
Must have been a pretty big rock.
It was. They were both very large rocks.
Boulders, really?
Very, yeah. So a ton, 1 ton boulder.
They're not pebbles we're talking about.
No.
Couldn't fit all the stuff on a pebble. Yeah.
So I did that, and I wrote these words, all these feelings that I felt that I was getting from them and that I wanted to get rid of out of my life because I never felt like they loved me or cared about me. Or even respected me. I was a respected person in my community. I'd raised two beautiful children. I reunited with my adopted daughter. We have a great relationship. I was a successful person, and I still could never measure up. So I did these rocks, and I had my husband film me, and I went down to the lake, and I threw them in, and I threw them as far as I could, and it was just like this huge 1 ton boulder off of my heart. And it was so freeing because I cut them both completely out of my life. And before I had suffered debilitating depression, I had been on antidepressants off and on through the years. I had so many therapy, so much therapy, counseling. My poor husband, he's so dedicated to me. And I couldn't be where I am today without his help as well. And he wasn't raised in a Christian family. His family wasn't even a Christian family.
But they took more care of you than our own family.
Yes, they weren't even Christians. Yeah, they're the ones that took me in. My best friend's mother, her family, and then I ended up marrying my best friend's brother 35 years later. And wonderful marriage and great life. I just wouldn't trade it for anything. But all that feelings of inferiority and guilt and anxiety was gone. That minute I threw those rocks into the lake, cut those people out of my life, I'm done. It's over. And what a freedom. I could almost feel myself grow emotionally and mentally. It was like, wow, I got out of prison. I feel like I got out of prison.
Stepping into the light for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd gone to so many different churches looking for the answer. You know, where's this loving God, this nurturing God? I don't see it. The Christians that are going to my church are horrible people. They're treating me bad too. We finally left the church. We said, that's it, we're done. We're getting treated worse by these so-called Christians than we were these any non-Christian friends. So much better.
Yes.
And finally, we'd had it. We threw the towel in and quit going to church. And even that was really freeing. And I since have found God when I hike. I find God up in the mountains or in the woods. And that's where I communicate with my God. And that's the loving and nurturing God that I found outside the church, outside my Christian family. You know, what a difference.
Yeah, and the truth is we need community, though. That's the sad truth, isn't it? Is that it's supposed to be in church, places like church.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, I guess it is. I'm not not just here to bash on the church, you know, but in both of our experiences, I think we share the same frustration of we just wanted to serve.
Yes.
Churches, we wanted to use our gifts.
Yep.
And time again, there's politics and all those and people treating us horribly and all this. And finally, Lisa and I, my wife and I, walked away. You guys walked away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sad thing, but it had to be done. So, you know, cutting certain members out of our family, they're just too toxic.
Yeah.
You know, as we wrap it up, I'd be curious, what would you say? What would be your advice to someone who's in a similar situation? You can imagine, let's say, a young girl, a young woman who's in the situation as yours, pregnant, not knowing what she's supposed to do. What advice could you give for someone in that scenario?
What I would say is find like-minded people that are going to support you and love you unconditionally.
Not
burden bearers.
No.
But find you, that is the hardest time of your life whether you choose to keep the child, which is going to be a hardship, give the child up for adoption, which is a different kind of hardship, an abortion, which is a different kind of hardship. There's no easy answer. But I would say find a group. There's a lot of support groups out there. I just recently, within the last year, finally discovered a group for adoptees and birth parents. I just started going to the support group. It's once a month. Life-changing for me because I've always felt isolated. I never knew another birth parent ever. So I had nobody to share that, the burdens that you carry, the guilt you carry. I mean, obviously today my adopted daughter has completely forgiven me and she knows my whole story.
She knows the story.
Get the support you need. Find the support groups that are going to support you. Whatever path you choose, there is no right. There is no wrong. But you've got to find it. And I would say don't go to the church because I tried doing therapy. Last year, I called a gal that was a therapist at a church. And her answer to me was, well, all the answers are in the Bible, what you need. And I said, well, I'm not finding that. I don't see anything about birth parents in the Bible. Well, I can't really counsel you, and I don't really know of any other Christian counselors that can even help you. And I said, fine, thank you for your time. And I hung up. So even today, I still can't find the support through the church that I need.
It's true, isn't it? This is something Steve Austin and I talked about on our podcast a few months ago, was that churches are just not equipped in so many cases to handle mental health issues and things like that, counseling. You know, at best, they might be able to refer you to a network at best, hopefully.
Yeah.
But the other thing I've found a lot of help and healing, I mentioned this before, is the Exvangelical group on Facebook.
Yes.
And I know you're toying with joining. Yeah, you should join the group because if it's a supportive community and you hear those stories and you go, that's me, that's me.
Yeah.
We were raised without a television. We were raised not being allowed to listen to secular music. We were raised in a stifling fundamentalist environment, and so many other people not only were, but they've come out of that, and they're finding this freedom that we found, you know, us out from underneath the burdens. We keep using that word, but that community helps us bear the burdens. I'll steal their phrase and use it on them.
Well, I think they're defunct now anyway, so it's okay.
It's a shame, really, that the burden bearers are gone, and, you know, Bill Gothard's sort of in disgrace, but he's still fighting to try to clear his name and everything.
Ludicrous.
But I was going to say, right at the very end, if people wanted to get a hold of you, Valerie, is there a way that someone could find you on social media? Or
just contact you, and you can contact me, and then I'm happy to talk to anybody. I've got so much experience under my belt that, you know,
yeah, maybe that's the best way to start. If someone had listened to this podcast and said, I need to talk to Valerie, contact me and I'll put you in touch with her.
Yep.
And then you can kind of go from there. We've had people contact us before and I put them in touch with my wife, Lisa, you know, who were going through similar things when she shared her abortion story. So, you know, there are people out there listening that this story will impact and it will touch. So thank you very much, Valerie Haycock Cunningham.
Yes.
I will say that's your maiden name, for being a part of this podcast and just being willing and vulnerable to share your story.
Yeah, thank you.
I know it's a powerful story.
Yeah.
And there's
emotional.
More life ahead.
We're the best part of life now.
The best part of life ahead. We're in the second half of life now.
Thank
so
you,
who
Richard
knows
Rohr.
What is going to happen next.
Yep.
Well, if you've been listening to this podcast and you want to get a hold of Valerie or myself, give us your thoughts, comments, feedback. That would be fantastic. I would love it. You can contact me. You can email me. That might be the easiest way. preachersforum@gmail.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter and send me a message that way, @preachersforum. You can find me also on Instagram, @preachersforum as well. You can also stop by my website, preachersforum.com, where I tend to write a lot of follow-up articles on these podcasts. So keep an eye on that as well. The Preachers Forum blog is called preachersforum.com. And then finally, you can support the work of Mindshift. if this has helped you, if it has been beneficial to you, thought-provoking, challenging, whatever, you can help me keep this podcast going for as little as $1 a month. You can do that by going to patreon.com/preachersforum. And there's a little video there that talks about the vision of why I started what was originally the Preacher's Forum podcast, but now that's been changed to Mindshift. And so you can help me spend money on things like podcast hosting, equipment upgrades, travel expenses, and all kinds of other things to keep this podcast going. And join the Mindshift podcast group on Facebook. So become part of that community as well. All right, I'm going to let you go now. Thank you once again for listening to myself and Valerie talk about our stories. And I will see you next week right here on Mindshift.